This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting WLRN Public Media in Miami. Trump urges unity versus racism. That was a page one headline in the New York Times yesterday, for a few hours. The Times reported what Mr. Trump said, that white supremacy is bad, but the headline gives the impression of him as a unifying voice on race. The paper changed the headline for later editions after people mocked and criticized it on social media. It's just one example of the ongoing debate in many newsrooms, how to cover and describe racism. That R word can be a kind of thought stopper. It slams our minds shut and flings our emotions wide open. If you already believe Donald Trump is a racist, how does that impact the way you consume news about him? If you don't, what's the right way to help you reconsider? And for that matter, should the news tell you what to think or just tell you the facts? Or maybe a bit of both. Joining us from St. Petersburg, Florida, is Kelly McBride, the Senior Vice President of the Poynter Institute, a professional school for journalists. She is the chair of Poynter's Craig Newmark Center for Ethics and Leadership. Kelly, welcome back to 1A.
Hey, Joshua.
Joining us from NPR in New York is NBC's Ben Collins. He covers online extremism and disinformation. Ben, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Back at our home base in Washington is Univision's Washington correspondent, Fernando Pizarro. Fernando, glad to have you back, too.
Yes, thank you.
Kelly, let me start with you. Earlier in your career, you covered white supremacists in Idaho. Tell me a bit about that experience and what you learned as it related to reporting on supremacy.
Yeah, so in one of my very first jobs in journalism, I was a police reporter in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I worked for the Spokane Spokesman Review. And I was surprised to learn that there was a whole department of the FBI in Coeur d'Alene, and they were there to monitor the activities of the Aryan Nations, which was a white supremacist group that was run by Richard Butler. And there were numerous white supremacists throughout North Idaho. And one of my first assignments was to cover a skinhead march in the middle of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And I was totally unprepared to do that. And what I did with following the lead of other reporters at the paper, was to document the ideology, the things that they were saying, and their critique of America in a way that drew outrage from the rest of our community, because the rest of our community felt like this was such a small group of people, you know, a couple of hundred to at times 1,000. They were so angry at us for documenting it. And what I learned in the 15 years that I worked at that newspaper and in that community was that it was still very important to show the community who was living among us and what they believed and what they were espousing. But it was also really important to cover the dialogue between that set of beliefs and the broader community. And this was before the internet, right? And so it was a troubling, difficult time for us as journalists, but we did not have the complications of the internet. Because what the FBI agents would tell us is that when we would give them voice, we would actually bring them believers also, because more people would reach out to them. And So balancing that was very difficult as a journalist, because it's not my job to tell people to not believe something. It's my job to hold up a mirror to the community and say, hey, this is who you are. Do you really want to be this?
Ben Collins, since we now do live in an age of the internet, I wonder what your sense is of how covering white supremacy has changed, particularly since the 2016 election.
I think it's difficult. I completely agree with what was just said there. You know, we have to be extremely careful not to amplify, just to bring about, show what their message is in the context of history, and show, you know, for example, that white supremacist nations, ethnostates, have typically failed, and show generally as well that sort of hatred brings about a lot of death, a lot of suffering, and not a lot of otherwise positive things. I think that's something that you have to show through context. And you can say it's racist because they will admit it's racist. They are racists generally. The difficult thing with the internet generally is that the things said by leaders are not just echoed, but they're amplified times 10, because that's the point of extremism. They always take it 10 notches above what the common, you know, what the common rhetoric is around specific things. For example, immigration. You know, 8chan and 4chan, these sites that are now getting a lot of attention, they were always – they were pro-Trump during the 2016 election, but they were always a little bit, you know, further than him at every step. You know, when he called Mexicans rapists, things like that, they're like, yes, now let's act on it, right? That's the difference, is that they take it to the next step on these places. They, you know, there's a lot of people who say that these sites don't – or the people who put up these manifestos don't support the president. In a lot of ways, they support his rhetoric, but they don't support the way he's going about handling it, and they want to take it another step further. And that's something that we struggle with as, you know, as news reporters. We want to be able to say, hey, these people are taking the most extreme version of what the president is saying, but we don't want to say outright that they are, you know, directly working with him in any way, because that's not true either.
Fernando, can you take us back to last weekend and the editorial decisions that went into the coverage of the mass shooting in El Paso, particularly the investigation into the gunman and his views? Give me your sense of what it was like kind of in the moment, making editorial decisions about what to say, what not to say, and how to say it.
Well, Josh, first of all, our company, which is you know, the network is headquartered in Miami, has mobilized a lot of resources to El Paso, also to Dayton. But we've had a lot of our Texas stations as well, having a lot of teams there right now and since this weekend. Of course, the intensity of the coverage has increased, not only since this weekend. We have to go back to what happened in California the weekend before in Gilroy, where also Latinos were targeted. So we've had two specials, one last night about network specials. So one particularly centering on how Latinos and are being targeted. And this goes back for a long time. So this is just a continuation of what our coverage has been since the fateful day that when Donald Trump announced his candidacy back in 2015. And many in our audience felt attacked. This is a deeply personal topic for many in our audience and within our network. So basically, yes, we've increased our coverage. We are, you know, you have to realize that here, you know, when we're talking about El Paso, you're talking about it's such a binational city that. We're able to tap both sides of the border on this particular coverage. So it's been and it's going to continue, obviously, for the next few days and weeks.
Let's add another voice to our conversation before we continue. Also with us now is Jane Costin, a senior politics reporter for Vox, who focuses on white nationalism and the far right. Jane, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Love to get your reaction before we take our first break to a clip from CNN's Chris Cuomo and Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke. They spoke last night. Mr. O'Rourke is an El Paso native and has been very, very outspoken about the president's rhetoric, among others. I want to get your reaction to this exchange because it's kind of at the heart of pretty much everything we're going to discuss this hour. Listen.
I've heard the critique. Oh, he didn't write that. Fair enough. But he said the words, and he did say white supremacy is hate and should be treated as domestic terror.
Yeah. Important for you then to say that this is the same man who called white nationalists and Klansmen and neo-Nazis very fine people, who asked for more immigrants who look like those in Sweden and Norway, the whitest places on the planet, while describing immigrants from Haiti as full of AIDS or countries in Africa as nations. This is the most racist president we've had since perhaps Andrew Johnson in another age, in another century. And he is responsible for the hatred and the violence that we're seeing right now. You cannot leave that just to me to say that. It's got to be you and those who are helping this country understand what is happening in our name to connect those dots of these actions that can seem unconnected or disparate or random or just strange. They're not. They're all of a pattern.
That's Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke speaking to CNN's Chris Cuomo yesterday. But I do take Mr. O'Rourke's point, and it seems like the issue here is content versus context. I'd like to get your thoughts on that, Jane, in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from CarMax. For more than 25 years, CarMax has made it easy to sell your car. They provide free appraisals and offers on the spot. CarMax will buy your car even if you don't buy theirs. In fact, CarMax has bought more than 8 million vehicles. To learn more and schedule your free appraisal, visit CarMax.com.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of NPR's Hidden Brain.
Think deeply.
Here to tell you about our summer series, You 2.0. Ideas and advice about how you can respond to life's chaos.
Just do a just check to my inbox. Just check, just check, just check to my phone real quick.
With wisdom. Listen to Hidden Brain every week.
Jane Costin, let me pick up with you and that statement from Beto O'Rourke. It seems like the issue is kind of content versus context and how we balance those two.
Exactly. First, I'd like to note that there have been a lot of racist presidents since Andrew Johnson. I'm thinking of Woodrow Wilson, for example. But I also think that there's the back and forth about the content and the context is worth having, because I think, you know, one of the things that I get really concerned about working on this beat is that everything is so tied to Trump. You know, white nationalism has a long history in this country. White nationalist violence is a long history in this country. The worst domestic terror attack that ever took place in this country was Oklahoma City bombing on April 19th, 1994. And that obviously took place well before the Trump presidency. But I do think that the context, the constant uses of certain terminology, and how much Trump, the view that the Trump administration and Trump himself seems to have of his own base, that his base will respond best to that kind of messaging. I think that that's something that I'm glad that both Cuomo and O'Rourke kind of picked up on. I think it's concerning when this becomes about, you know, this is because of Trump. No, this is because of the long history of white nationalism and white nationalist sentiment that have existed in this country for decades. This is because law enforcement has been unwilling or unable to really challenge how radicalization takes place. It has, you know, how it took place in the 1980s and how it takes place today. But I think that having the conversation about what the context, what the available context in which these shootings are taking place is happening, and how that ties to this current presidency, I think that that's a conversation well worth having.
We asked you what you wanted from the press after these twin tragedies this weekend in El Paso and Dayton. Glad to have gotten a number of your voicemails, including this one from Cindy that landed in our inbox.
My name is Cindy from Tucson, Arizona, and I hold Trump responsible for all of this hate in this country. Can we talk about him retweeting a white supremacist from England, Katie Hopkins, who called immigrants cockroaches and called for a final solution for Muslims? How about his supporters yelling, shoot them, when Trump asked what we should do about this invasion of immigrants? Let's talk about that, please, a little bit.
Yes, Cindy, good point. Thank you for bringing those up. And just by way of context, Cindy is referring to a campaign rally that President Trump held in Panama City, Florida, back in May, where he said something to the effect of, what should we do about this invasion? And someone in the audience yelled, shoot them! And then people started laughing, and the president said something to the effect of, only in Panama City could you get away with that. Only here in Panama City. And everybody had a pretty good laugh about that. But Ben Collins, with regards to what Cindy said in terms of retweets, what's your perspective on that? So you said only in the panhandle could you get away with that. What's your perspective on that? Some people have taken the president to task for what he's written. Others have taken him to task for what he has kind of amplified. Do we count both of those the same? Do we contextualize those differently? How do you see it?
So it is a coordinated campaign strategy by the Trump campaign generally. What he retweets and who he retweets. He does, in fact, dig pretty deep into Twitter to find, you know, random, for example, QAnon accounts recently, which is a conspiracy theory that believes that Hillary Clinton is a like a Satanist pedophile, he's dug deep to retweet those people recently, or somebody on his staff has. And that is part of a campaign strategy that he has deployed ever since Brad Parscale, who used to be his digital director, became his campaign director. Parscale is known to be a part of what I would call like the MAGA internet. He said he's big on the Donald, which is a Reddit forum where a lot of really gross stuff happens. That's where a lot of these memes come from, and that's how they get pushed up to the top. And frankly, those sorts of memes and those spaces intermingle with white nationalist rhetoric and white supremacist rhetoric and other white nationalist forums generally. They share lots of user bases. So those talking points can seep in through that sort of thing. And it is, again, it's part of a coordinated digital campaign strategy. Don't disassociate those two things. They know what they're doing. This is very deliberate. So, that's the difference here, is that, you know, he understands that he's dog whistling, and that can't be discounted.
Ferdinando, the Washington Post's Margaret Sullivan wrote a column on Sunday asking, quote, "Can the news media go on a righteous crusade about gun laws or white supremacy while maintaining their roles as truth tellers?" Unquote. I put this to you partly because Jorge Ramos, who is the primary anchor of Noticiero Univision, which is the nightly newscast on Univision, has been quite outspoken on a number of matters related to immigration, to the president. He's still the Lester Holt of Univision. And there are a lot of networks that have to kind of figure out this balance of being able to speak to the souls of their audience while still doing straight-ahead shoe-leather reporting. How do you see that balance?
Do we have enough time? Well, we have, as I said earlier, we have to take it back to that fateful day of the announcement of his candidacy, when he came down the escalator in New York, and he basically insulted, referred to Mexicans. You may recall that the outrage among Latinos about the words that Trump spoke then at that speech. They went through all types of nationalities. All Latinos and many Latinos in the U.S. Felt offended, even Puerto Ricans who are U.S. citizens. And then you go back to Jorge, who was kicked out of a press conference by Donald Trump himself in Iowa during the primary season in 2015. And so I think, it's become personal in a way, but at the same time, we have to, we were talking about content versus context. We have not called on the air or on our digital coverage Trump racist. We still use attribution to see who is calling his comments racist, and that's very important.
Kelly McBride, with regards to context, let me play a clip from a story that CNN's Sarah Seidner did last month about white supremacy. This was after President Trump tweeted a number of racist tweets against four progressive congresswomen, Ayanna Pressley, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib. In the course of that report, she spoke to Richard Spencer, an avowed white supremacist, a leader of the so-called alt-right. Here is a piece of that story with Sarah Seidner's narration within it. And then, Kelly, I'd like to get your take on it on the other side. Listen.
White nationalist Richard Spencer, who hailed Trump when he was first elected, is among those who are turning on Trump.
Many white nationalists will eat up this red meat that Donald Trump is throwing out there. I am not one of them. I recognize the con game that is going on.
They say Trump is all talk and no action on maintaining white dominance in America.
He gives us nothing outside of racist tweets. And by racist tweets, I mean tweets that are meaningless and cheap and express the kind of sentiments you might hear from your drunk uncle while he's watching Hannity.
Yes, that was Richard Spencer, the man who championed the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, who believes that whites should live separately from non-whites and Jewish people, him calling the president's tweet outright racist. But to be clear, there are many white nationalists, supremacists, neo-Nazis, whatever racist group they adhere to, who believe that the president is still their best choice.
That's a clip from a piece by CNN's Sarah Seidner that aired last month. Now, Kelly, would you unpack that for us? On one hand, she does attempt to contextualize his statements. On the other hand, she interviewed a white supremacist who got his perspective on the air. How do we balance that?
Well, in particular, I think she missed the point, because what he was saying is all he does is talk racism, but he doesn't enact any policies to protect white people. He doesn't make racist policies. And that's Spencer's objection to the president. Not that he's racist and racism is a bad thing, but there's no that there's no action behind his racist words. And so I think, you know, the danger in giving somebody like Spencer a platform is you legitimize him, and you make him more attractive to people who would support him in a variety of ways, including taking action on his suggestions. The problem is that for democracy to work, all the citizens need to know what the lay of the land looks like. And so you need to know as a citizen that this philosophy exists and that the president either is or is not doing enough to placate these people. And you have an obligation to reconcile your own moral choices against that backdrop. But as a journalist, it is very difficult, particularly in the broadcast medium, to do good journalism on this, because you end up both doing good and harm. You educate the public and you amplify a fringe message.
Jane Costin, I wonder how you see it. I mean, this idea of doing good and harm, I understand in terms of amplifying Richard Spencer. On the other hand, I need to know that there is a Richard Spencer out there and what he thinks. I mean, James Baldwin once said, not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced. How can you do anything about a Richard Spencer until you hear him in the clear, regardless of how you feel about him? How can we do anything about it if we don't hear exactly what he thinks?
The thing is, we're not hearing exactly what he thinks. You know, Richard Spencer is a white nationalist who's also a fairly practiced media professional. He will say things that will be reflective of what he wants you to know. I think it's actually markedly similar to how we treat terrorist manifestos. Terrorist manifestos are not diaries. They were meant to be shared and meant to be spread. Richard Spencer believes in he supports a concept of passive ethnic cleansing of the United States. And I think that, you know, I've spent a lot of time talking to white nationalists and talking about white nationalism. And when you talk to them, they very much try to position their views in a way that they think you will find less offensive. For instance, one white nationalist I spoke to, talked about his opposition to what he called race mixing, as in mixed race marriages, by mentioning that Muhammad Ali seemed to say the same thing in like 1967, as if that would be something I would respond to by saying like, ah, yes, Muhammad Ali opposes my parents' marriage, I should be fine with that also. And I think it's worth noting, you know, racists lie because racism is built on lies. And I think that when we're talking about Richard Spencer, it's worth noting both, you know, I understand the urge to kind of want to hear what he's saying, but he is saying what he thinks you want to hear. You know, when Richard Spencer is talking to Peter Brimlow or to others, that, you know, to people at American Renaissance or to others within the world of kind of the professional white nationalist right, he is talking very differently than how he's going to talk to CNN in a way that's going to seem placating and kind, where he's talking about racism. Though, as my co-panelist points out, he is saying that Trump isn't doing enough racist actions. He's just saying racist things. And, you know, but he means that he doesn't approve of the lack of action.
Ben Collins, I'd love to get your sense of how you deal with that kind of content when you kind of can't avoid it, when it's your beat. We got to pause in a minute. I'd like to get your sense of some of the guiding principles, some of the techniques, some of the standards that you keep in mind when you're doing that work. Let me get to a few of your comments before we pause. The 64 bus tweeted, "The news should not tell people what to think. That is opinion, not news. In order to be called a news program, they should only be able to report the facts. This is one of the biggest problems with our 24-hour quote-unquote news cycle. We need more facts, less opinion." Kyle wrote on our Facebook page, "I don't know why media sugarcoats everything from our leaders, no matter who they are. If they lie, call it a lie. If they say something racist, say it. If they say something hypocritical, call it out in no uncertain terms. Why coddle those who are supposed to lead?" Good point, Kyle. There are certain things I gotta say that I'm perfectly fine calling out someone who, for example, says climate change has nothing to do with human activity. Where is it okay to call someone out? Stay close.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from the United States Postal Service. Every day, innovative companies are reinventing the way business happens. But none of that is possible without the right people. People who get packages to over 150 million delivery points affordably and on time with the latest technology and expertise. Who can help you deliver the future of commerce? The United States Postal Service. See why they deliver more e-commerce packages to homes than anyone in the country at usps.com/future.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA. Every week, we bring you a mix of reporting, diverse voices, and coverage of current and emerging issues that impact our lives. Latino USA is one of a kind, featuring stories from the heart, stories that make you think and maybe even inspire you to action. Listen and subscribe now.
Ben, let me pick up where we left off in terms of your best practices for reporting on extremism. Jane, I'd love to know if you would add anything to Ben's thoughts. But Ben, how do you handle this?
It's a very delicate balance and definitely more art than science at this point. I think using the Richard Spencer example specifically, he views us as a weapon in a war for white supremacy. And that's something that we have to take into account when we deal with him. There's this thing called the Overton window, which the right talks about a lot. A better way of colloquially talking about it is called working the refs, basically. They always want to take they view that there is a center that is movable, that if you move things to the right enough, that the center will move along with it. And every time people like Richard Spencer, media manipulators generally, and frankly, a lot of the right-wing media ecosystem right now works in this fashion, they view access to mainstream press as an ability to move the entire political ecosystem in their direction. And there are people on the left that do this as well, obviously. This is a well-worn path. But when you allow people to get an unfettered, weaponized message out as a way to poison the pipes, basically, poison the information pipes, then you are allowing toxic sewage to go through that pipe. So if you allow a man to, you know, who's a professional manipulator, who's a professional racist, like Richard Spencer is, to come on and say his precise message in a way that will allow white supremacy to be more accepted, you are doing the work for him. You need to contextualize who he is. You need to take his, weapon away from him. You need to allow him to exist because he is obviously in existence and a person who is a newsmaker. But you can't allow him to spread his message on his own terms when we know how dangerous it can be.
Last month, NPR decided to call a number of tweets from President Trump directing that group of female lawmakers to go back to their home countries racist, the ones we mentioned before, the four progressive congresswomen. That resulted in an opinion piece that was on NPR.org from NPR's VP of Newsroom Training and Diversity, Keith Woods, who used to be with the Poynter Institute, worth noting. Keith argued that NPR News should not call the president's tweets racist, and he discussed it on NPR's podcast Code Switch.
If you were applying the standards that we applied to what the president said Sunday, I can't think of how many times we ought to have referred to the language as racist using that standard. And my overall problem is that we don't really have a standard. And I'm not arguing this because we're inconsistent. I'm arguing this because we sit on a very fragile credibility as a profession, different from every other profession out there. And that credibility rests in part on the view of the public that we are maintaining some distance, our judgments, our morals, some distance from the things that we're covering.
That's NPR's Vice President of Newsroom Training and Diversity, Keith Woods. Jane Costin, how does that compare or contrast with the way that you approach these kinds of stories?
For me, you know, I came into the world of journalism through sports. And so, you know, when I was covering, say, the NFL or college football, you it's very easy to just be like, this is what happened. Here's what this person said. Here's what the score was. Here's how this play worked out. And I am much more willing to say that something is racist not because I think that there is, you know, some sort of deep moral power behind calling something racist, which I think we're seeing clearly right now, that a lot of people who think that they are deeply troubled by racism on all sides of the aisle actually aren't. But I think that it is a descriptor. It is not an insult. It is not, we've seen a lot of people who seem to be extremely offended by being called racist, almost more offended than, you know, they would be by the racism itself. It's a descriptor. And I think in many cases that we've been seeing more recently, it's accurate. I'm completely willing to say that, you know, someone who takes part in racist actions, who puts forward racist policies, or with the intent of causing harm to communities of non-white people, of which I am a part, you know, I am completely fine with calling that racist. I mean, I didn't go to journalism school, but I can see what racism is.
J2 tweeted, "Personally, I just want to hear the facts and form my own opinion, but lately I've noticed that there is a need to educate some folk, especially those who've never had to worry about racism. Also, I do enjoy it when lying pundits and politicians are fact-checked in real time." Kelly, I wonder if there is ever a point from your view in which the ethical guidelines kind of point to, we have to say something about that.
So the first thing you have to do is gather the evidence. You have to report the story. You have to report the connections between people who are working in the Trump administration and their belief systems. And you have to identify who is influencing this president. And then when you have all the goods, that's when you call it out. And that's what we need journalism to do now, is not just to observe, but to observe and make conclusions. But you can only do that with a lot of work. It's very, very hard to do on cable television when you have 24 hours a day to fill. It takes a lot of resources. And that's what we're relying on.
Jane, anything you would add to that?
I think that the most important thing here, you know, a lot of stories have recently focused on how racism or racist invective plays among white audiences and white voters, but not among the people who are most impacted by racist invective, and those are communities of color. You know, yeah. I think that the people who you know, I'm sure you and I and a lot of non-white journalists right now, our email inboxes look a little bit different than the people we work alongside. And that's not even beginning to talk about the people who were killed in El Paso, the people who were killed at the Tree of Life Synagogue, the lives that have been shattered by white nationalism, even when it doesn't come to abject violence. I think we need to focus on the victims of white nationalism, not on whether or not it's politically effective.
Ben, anything you would add?
I think that's precisely right. I think we have underplayed what happens to victims, and we don't check in on them after this takes place. We don't check in on these families months later because it's no longer in the news. But we always check in on anti-immigrant rhetoric, and we always check in on if it's a positive thing or a negative thing about what the president's talking about. But we don't talk about the permanent effects this has on people once they lose a family member or once they've seen a shooting and maybe even they got out alive. We don't talk about that because it's complicated and it doesn't fit in the moment of our news judgment.
Ben Collins covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet for NBC News. Ben, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Thank you.
Kelly McBride, the senior VP at the Poynter Institute and chair of the Craig Newmark Center for Ethics and Leadership. Kelly, thank you.
You're welcome.
Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Vox with a focus on white nationalism. Jane, we appreciate your time. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Univision's Washington correspondent, Fernando Pizarro. Thank you, Fernando.
Thank you, Josh.
It's been a busy 2 days, and our entire team has come together to put these shows together. You can learn more about them at theoneA.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.